funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do immigrants contribute to the culture and economy of the United States, and what do they gain for themselves? As lawmakers continue to debate what to do about the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. today, some native-born Americans worry that all these newcomers might make it harder for U.S. citizens to thrive. But as my guest today will tell us, the debate over immigration is rife with myths about why people move to this country and how they behave once they arrive. Alvaro Vargas Llosa is senior fellow at the Independent Institute. His new book is called Global Crossings: Immigration, Civilization, and America. Alvaro, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, for many native-born Americans today, immigration somehow feels like a different issue than it was in the era in which their own families might have arrived here. But in fact, we have a long history of both priding ourselves on being a nation of immigrants and somehow worrying every time there's a new wave of people that they present a risk of changing what we love about living in America.
Yes, that's correct. It is true that Americans have always prided themselves on being a country of immigrants, but it's also true that at every in every important period regarding immigration in U.S. history, there was always a current of opinion, a significant one, that was skeptical of immigration, that was worried, fearful of the impact that immigration might have on its way of life, on its livelihood, on pretty much the same things that today compel many people in the United States to look at immigration with a lot of fear. So I would say it's been a very mixed bag, and at no point really has there been a total consensus about this, which is why it's important to continue to make the right points, because really this is a debate that will probably never be won outright, but one hopes that it'll move in the right direction on balance.
It's also worth noting that a lot of Americans have ancestors who arrived here before there were a lot of restrictions on migration.
That is correct. I mean, the important restrictions began for European immigrants in the early 20th century, in the 1920s. However, for Asian immigrants, they really came into being a lot earlier than that. I mean, in the 19th century, during the Gold Rush, for instance, there was a tremendous backlash against the Chinese. And then a bit later than that, the backlash was against the Japanese, and including in the early 20th century against the Japanese. After that, there was a backlash against Southern and Eastern and Central Europeans, as opposed to Northern and Western Europeans, as I say, in the 1920s. So it really depends where your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came from. I mean, if they came from Italy or they came from Poland or Russia, then they will have been affected by the 1920s. If they came from Western and Northern Europe, they would not. They would have been, in fact, benefited by those laws, because those laws were really seeking to keep out Southern and Eastern Europeans. And if you were, you know, if you are of sort of Asian descent, then you have a long history of legal harassment, as it were. But also, of course, periods of tolerance. I mean, this is never a black and white story.
What kinds of resources and education do would-be immigrants need to have in order to sort of be welcomed to the United States with open arms?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to tell, because all the immigrant communities that in time came to be seen in a positive light originally had very few educational tools. And yet they were able to make their way in U.S. society and contribute to the U.S. economy. I mean, we were talking a moment ago about, Italians and even Irish immigrants. Well, their educational tools were even fewer than, say, very, very poor Central Americans or Mexicans today, who are usually pointed, you know, people point at them as examples of people who are not really at this point prepared in the way they should to contribute to U.S. society. Well, the same thing was said of, and the same perception prevailed at the time about Italian and Irish immigrants. There's always been a so-called, to use a very modern category, low-skilled immigration, and time has shown that both at the lower end of the scale, the economic and of the socioeconomic scale, and at the higher end, there were people that the U.S. needed, and there were people that were able to contribute, of course, in different ways. Today, there are several industries that are really heavily dependent on low-skilled immigrants. Not to mention, of course, the fact that there's also a native, in other words, a U.S.-born issue regarding education. I mean, the number of high school dropouts who are native, who are born in the U.S., is three times larger than the number of immigrant high school dropouts, for instance. Hmm.
I thought this was interesting as well. You know, you mentioned the poverty, relative poverty of many new immigrants to this country. And of course, we have the sort of Emma Lazarus legend of accepting the poor, the tired, the huddled masses. But compared to people in the country of origin that they've left, even many low-skilled workers who come to this country are not among the poorest from their own societies.
That's correct. And that's, I think, a really important point. I mean, people sometimes have the impression that the people who migrate and particularly immigrate to the United States are the poorest among the poor, and that's never the case. If we take Latin America, which is at this point still the main source of immigration, although there are many other important sources, of course, Asia included, you will see that internal migration, in other words, people migrating within their country, is much greater than emigration. And then emigration doesn't always take place in one direction and doesn't always end up in the United States. I mean, migration from Central America to Mexico is very significant. Migration from countries like Bolivia to countries like Argentina has been very, very significant in the past. But internal migration in general, not just within Latin America, I mean, within particular countries, is much more significant. Why? Because the poorest among the poor tend to migrate from rural to urban areas within their borders. And the people who migrate to places like the United States from Latin America tend to be people who are a bit better off than they are, who are always or almost always people from a relatively urban background, people who have at least some means to travel. That is why the statistics are very surprising. I mean, the people who come to the United States, yes, for the most part, are low skilled at this point. If they originate their travel in Latin America, but the number of people who come here with some means, with a certain amount of ability to generate income, is very significant indeed.
What's the effect, Alvaro, of that outflow on the culture and the economies of the countries these immigrants leave behind?
Well, this is a very interesting situation, really, because it really works both ways. I mean, yes, there is to an extent, there is a drain of both brains and just workforce in general. But those immigrants who become immigrants at some point in say, in the United States, will give back to their country of origin in many ways, through trade, through remittances, through tourism, or just through the way they communicate back to their original countries what they learn, both about the capitalist society and about liberal democracy, in the country in which they make their living. So, of course, this last part is much more subtle and much more difficult to quantify. But there's no question that significant immigrant communities in the United States have had an influence back home in terms of reinforcing certain institutions, democracy, free market economics. I mean, I can speak, for instance, about the case of Peru, which is my country of origin. There's about 3 million Peruvians who migrated out of Peru in the last 25 years. There's many of them in the United States, but not just the United States. Many of them ended up in Europe, in Spain and Italy and other countries. They have become people who win elections. Have an increasingly important voice for political moderation, for economic modernity, as it were, globalization, and these kinds of things. And I don't know of any studies that have tried to quantify this and just turn this and translate this into quantifiable data, but it's a very, very significant impact and effect, not to speak, of course, of what I mentioned before, remittances. I mean, many of these countries, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, have for a while, now they're taking off and they're doing better, but for a while had remittances from immigrants as one of their key sources of income.
So if to go back to what you were just saying, if they retain voting rights, they have the ability in some cases to help change the country from the outside in.
That's right. And that's why, for instance, many well-known and high-profile Mexicans in the United States have for years pressured their country of origin, the Mexican government, to allow Mexicans here to vote. For years, this has been a really important debate. Of course, with such a significant number of immigrants here from Mexico, there was always a worry back home in Mexico that they would exert, overwhelming influence on any process. So there's been a big debate there. There were also nationalistic reasons why they weren't allowed to vote. But this debate among Mexicans here and back home has been very significant. In other countries, such as Peru, they have been allowed to vote for a long time, and they have become so important that all the parties, the main parties, send people overseas for a few weeks in every election campaign to campaign heavily in areas where there's a large concentration of immigrants. In the case of Peruvians, they would come, for instance, to New Jersey, places like Patterson, where there's a very important community. Colombians have also been allowed to vote, and in Madrid, in Spain, for instance, that's always been a very lively part of the campaign and process. This poses an interesting issue for the country of origin of all these people.
How do fluctuations in the domestic economy of the United States act as a sort of natural regulator for the flow of immigrants?
Oh, it's a very direct impact. You can trace this really to every recession there's been in the last, say, half century, and most recent one, after 2007, 2008, when the bubble burst, when the credit bubble burst, you saw a slowdown, a significant drop in immigration, so much so that between 2005 and 2010, net immigration came down to zero. In other words, by 2010, you really had as many people going back out, leaving, as you had coming in. And probably, they don't have statistics at this point for 2011 that are entirely reliable yet. I mean, they will come out soon, I'm sure. But every indication is that by 2011, net migration was probably negative. In other words, more people leaving and going out. In 2000 and 2001, when the dot-com bubble burst, the U.S. had a, of course, much shorter recession, there was a significant drop in immigration almost immediately. I mean, in the 1990s, there had been a lot of immigration, people coming in droves. I mean, half a million, 600,000, 700,000 per year. And then suddenly you saw a very, very big drop after 2001. So, yes, there's a very direct relationship between conditions, the prevailing conditions in the United States, and the number of immigrants coming in.
My guest is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute and author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He is senior fellow at the Independent Institute and author of the new book, Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Alvaro, how does the presence of immigrants willing and able to provide unskilled labor for a relatively low wage affect job prospects for native-born Americans?
Well, I mean, immigrants in general, what they do is they enlarge the pie, as it were. There have been several very authoritative studies. One very important study was conducted by a critic of immigration, George Borges from Harvard. He, many years ago, he calculated that the contribution to the economy in general, so that would include all low-skilled immigrants as well, was amounted to about $22 billion per year. So what we did is we updated that figure. And again, this is a critic of immigration. So that would translate today into almost $40 billion annually, and this includes every illegal immigrant, a significant number of whom are, of course, low-skilled immigrants. So they make the pie larger because they are both producers and consumers. At the very low end, they allow natives to move up. They also help keep those labor-intensive services in which they work relatively cheap or cheaper than they would be, which means that all consumers will benefit. And in terms of wages, they do have a very slight impact. We estimate that it's about 1.5%. In other words, wages do drop temporarily by about 1.5%. That is immediately offset by the rising wages of all the people who are able to move up the scale because of this to more sort of managerial type jobs. In general, one way to look at this is to understand that the way it works with immigration is exactly the same way it works with internal migration within the United States or with just generally the U.S. economy. I mean, since the Second World War, or rather since actually 1950, because of the incorporation, of course, of women into the workforce and also baby boomers, about 90 million to 100 million people have joined the workforce. Their contribution has been very significant, and there has been at no point anything like the kind of long-term unemployment that people tend to associate with the idea of having too many immigrants in the United States. If immigrants were to cause the kind of economic disruption that people fear, then it would have been the case that those 90 to 100 million Americans that were incorporated into the workforce in the last half century would have caused absolutely massive disruption, and among them, there were a lot of people, of course, who were at the lower end of the scale.
So, how does the lack of legal status affect the extent to which undocumented immigrants can participate in the U.S. economy?
Well, I mean, they're forced, of course, into the shadows, which means that not only they're not able to be as productive as they would be otherwise, but also that they are not always able to enter the kinds of industries they might be able to contribute to in other circumstances. And yet it is also interesting to note that many immigrants are able to, despite these legal obstacles, are able to spread out, as it were, throughout the economy much more than people realize. In other words, the concentration in certain industries is not as big as people think. By our calculation, only about, in the case of, say, Hispanics, only about 22% of them would need to change jobs to mirror the occupational distribution of natives. Yes, there is a certain amount of concentration in certain services or industries, for instance, in construction and that kind of thing. But again, the numbers are lower than people think. It's about only about 11% of them. About a third are in the type of managerial jobs that people don't really associate with immigration, but that's almost a third, 30%. It's very huge. About 22 to 25% are in services. Again, not of the type that one necessarily associates with immigration immediately. So they're really spread out throughout the economy, although it is true still that, of course, because of low-skill immigration, there is a certain amount of concentration in particular industries that people do associate immediately with immigration.
What about consumption of social services, of seats in schools, of things that collectively American taxpayers are footing the bill for?
Well, this is probably, along with border security, the most controversial aspect of immigration. All sorts of studies have been made, and all sorts of data are kind of thrown around all the time. One thing that I think needs to be taken into account is that the immigrants do pay taxes. They of course pay local and state taxes to begin with. I mean, everything from gas to real estate. But surprisingly enough, they also pay things like Social Security in many instances, so much so that the government estimates that they pay about $7 billion, even though it's supposedly illegal for them to have even a Social Security card. The contribution that immigrants make to the accounts of the government are always difficult to estimate because, of course, a lot of this happens indirectly. I mean, immigrants help the overall economy, and therefore they help others earn more income, and therefore those people are able to pay more taxes. So I will need to factor that in to any calculation. It's also the fact that many immigrant children who are counted as immigrant are actually children of at least one U.S. parent. Again, from a statistical point of view, that is something that's not at all clear. However, I always quote one particular study that is very authoritative and is widely respected, which was made by the National Research Council many years ago. It was subsequently updated. What they did is they calculated the impact of legalizing every illegal immigrant or undocumented worker, and they projected the next 50 years. In other words, you need to take into account not just the immediate impact, but what will happen throughout the rest of the working lives of all these people in order to really make a fair assessment of their impact of their fiscal impact and the impact on social services. And what they came up with was very, very interesting because overall, if you take both low-skilled and high-skilled workers, the net effect, when you calculate the present value of all those 50 years into the future, the sum is a positive $80,000. If you only take unskilled workers, they come up with about $5,000 net cost, which is really very tiny in the large scheme of things, because this calculation is not taking into account how much the economy will grow because of legal immigrants in the future. So if you did take that into account, it would completely outweigh those $5,000. And again, this was conducted by an institution that's not part of this of the sort of ideological debate regarding immigration at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jerry in McKinney. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, I'm really excited and thrilled to hear someone clearing up a lot of the misinformation you hear about this subject. They're stealing our jobs, they don't pay taxes, et cetera, it's like, if they trot out the right person on the right news channel and repeat the lie enough times, people believe it. And it's really refreshing to hear some actual facts about the plight of the people that are just trying to make a living for their family and do better. My question is, given the way the politics are today, is there any hope for positive change? I mean, I can't find good workers like the people that I have now, and they're like family to me. I mean, I pay them as much as I can. A lot of people make up to 40 grand in my company. and they can't get a driver's license. They can't live like they should be allowed to. They're good contributing people, and it's very frustrating to me that we still have these bad policies.
Alvaro, what do you think?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, as you probably know, there's a bill currently trying to make its way from the Senate to the House. It was approved about a month and a bit more ago, but it's having a very hard time making its way to the House. There's a lot of resistance there. However, I am optimistic. I mean, I do know there's a lot of obstacles and there's a lot of bad feeling about this. But again, I think the overwhelming evidence is such that it's going to have a political effect, in the sense that I think politicians who are skeptical now will come to understand that it's in their own political interest to make positive change, because otherwise they will pay a very, very heavy penalty. I mean, we've seen that in recent elections, the way that the immigrant vote, both among Hispanics and Asians, the two largest groups, has been, I mean, so heavily skewed towards Democrats in ways that are, by historical standards, really overwhelming. And again, that I'm sure is at some point going to drive the point home. It's in the interest of skeptical Republicans, I think, at this point, to take another look and remember that various conservative icons in the past came to regard immigration in a different way. I mean, Ronald Reagan, of course, was one of them. And I mean, even later than that, people forget that before 9/11, one of the big ideas that George Bush wanted to really put into practice had to do with immigration. That was the first real proposal he made when he first came into government, the idea of bringing people out of the shadows, and he even went to Mexico, and you know, people now kind of tend to forget that. But again, I think it's going to be tough. It's going to be hard, but I think reality will eventually overcome these difficulties, simply because it's going to be in the political interest of skeptics at some point to acknowledge reality.
Let's talk about assimilation. You describe a sort of three-generation pattern that has existed at least since the 19th century. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, it's very similar to what went on in the past. I mean, what tends to happen is the first generation, of course, emigrates from the country of origin, so they kind of escape from the country of origin, so to speak, and they come to places like the United States. They make every effort to try to essentially survive in this new society. About 40% of them come speaking some rather good English, actually, and then the rest are really people who in some cases speak some English and others don't speak very much. Obviously, what they tend to do is they tend to live in communities where they feel safer and they feel more at home. That necessarily means joining other fellow nationals, as it were. The second generation is bilingual, but speaks English significantly better than their mother tongue, if you will. And by the third generation, they're only speaking English. And this is pretty much true of every community. Of course, there are a few exceptions here and there, but generally can be said of every community. That was exactly the case with people in the late 19th century and early 20th century. The pattern is pretty much the same. I looked, for instance, at outmarriage, which is always an interesting way to analyze assimilation. In other words, the number of immigrants who were in any particular immigrant community that were and are marrying beyond that community. And in the case of Mexicans, of second-generation Mexicans, it's even slightly higher than it was the case with Italians in the early 20th century. About 17% of Italians, of second-generation Italians, were marrying non-Italians and you know, mostly natives back then. Well, in the case of Mexicans, it's about 20%. The other way to measure this is how they move up the socioeconomic scale, and it's happening in pretty much the same way that it used to happen. Of course, because immigrants keep coming in, including low-skilled immigrants, you're always going to find significant pockets of people who are at the lower end. But the way to measure this is really to look at how people who've come here at a certain point have done in the last, say, 10 years or so. And the pattern is pretty much the same. People move up the scale. By the second generation, they are doing much better than their parents.
In large segments of the country, the focus tends to be on reducing the numbers of immigrants who come and work here. But you say we need to look ahead to a future when we might, in fact, find ourselves competing to attract immigrant workers. What has changed in the world that makes that a possibility?
Well, two things. One is, of course, the fact that we live in a global world where we have an increasing exchange of goods and services. We have increasing capital being invested outside of the country where that capital originates. So just by definition, by default, you're going to see more and more people migrating from one place to another, unless we simply decide to go back to an era in which we don't communicate and exchange as much as we do. But that, at this point, really sounds very unlikely. The other reason is simply that countries that are where migration is originating at this point are beginning to do better, and they're beginning to develop themselves. So at some point, I've said that I can foresee a time when Americans will be wondering where they're going to find people to replace Mexicans, because Mexico is a country that's improving, at a very significant pace. They're doing, in fact, so well that you're seeing a trend in the last few years towards a drop in emigration. We'll need to, wait a few years to really determine this, but it really begins to look like it's a trend that's going to last. If Mexico, and they're undergoing now an interesting political process of reform, if they continue to do well and they do even better in the next few years, and they're able to grow, say, 5% to 6% per year, they will be able to absorb pretty much all of the new workforce every year. In other words, the young people coming into the workforce. If that happens, you will see a very significant drop in immigration in the United States, even in times of bonanza.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. His new book is called Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He is senior fellow at the Independent Institute and author of the new book Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Alvaro, before the break, you were telling us that if the growth of the Mexican economy continues apace, that there may come a time in the very near future when Mexico is able to absorb every new person who enters the workforce there as they come of age. Does that estimate include unskilled workers as well?
Yes, if they can grow at 5 or 6% per year, more 6 than 5%, they will be able to absorb pretty much every new worker. Meaning, at both ends of the scale. So that would mean a very significant drop in emigration. There will always be people who would rather work here than there, who will have family connections. Obviously, I'm not saying immigration will stop in general, but I'm saying that the drop will be very significant. We've seen that trend in the last few years. The number of emigrants has dropped very significantly. The problem with that statistic, of course, is that it kind of overlaps with the recession in the United States. So for this to really be a trend that we can establish as such, we need to wait a few more years. But the Mexican economy has been doing much better since the 1990s. It's become a manufacturing powerhouse. It's the biggest in Latin America. It's drawing back a lot of factories and plants from China, where they left a few years ago because of the attractive conditions over there. Now they're coming back to Mexico. Mexico is exporting a lot to the United States. So if all of those trends continue, I mean, I can easily foresee a time, you know, in the not too distant future where, you know, the U.S. businesses will begin to wonder where do we get them now? And so this will be interesting. I mean, some countries in other parts of the world are seeing this already. And you saw that. I mean, it's interesting. After the Second World War, you saw in Europe, when there was this sort of capitalist revival, the need for workers that they couldn't fight at home. And they were, I mean, at one point, European countries were kind of fighting for workers. So they kind of carved out the territory and decided, well, you know, these workers will be yours, these will be mine. So they made treaties with, you know, in the case of Germany, they made a treaty with Turkey, in the case of France, with Algeria, in the case of Spain, with Morocco, because they were just desperate for workers. So it's not a new thing. I mean, it's been happening for a long time.
So as you well know, ongoing discussions about immigration reform, any that have any hope of passing, include these provisions for really tightening our control of the southern borders. In part, it seems that reflects an anxiety that many native-born Americans have about the sort of illegal status of undocumented workers and what that might reflect about their overall tendency to commit crimes in other areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think people should realize this bill that was approved in the Senate and is trying to make its way to the House contemplates a lot of measures specifically, you know, regarding border security. The entire first title of the bill, it's divided into four titles. The entire first title is devoted just to that, and it contemplates, I mean, pretty much everything, you know, throwing another $30 billion over a decade towards border security, adding another 20,000 federal agents, a 700-mile fence, more surveillance drones. I mean, you name it. I doubt very much that if there's a demand for immigrants in the United States on the scale that there was, say, in the 90s or the early part of the 2000 decade, that these measures will be enough to keep them out, because just immigration is such a force that even with these kinds of measures, you're probably always going to see some kind of immigration. But again, I mean, people, if they have political objections to this, to this bill, they should not be on those grounds, because the bill just goes out of its way to please people who are, you know, worried about this aspect of the bill.
How important is it to draw a line between sort of regular kinds of crime that exist in any American community and terrorism?
Well, I mean, immigration policy and counterterrorism policy are and should be two different things, and there has been a tendency to confuse the two of them. If you look at the failures of policy, you know, in the last, say, since the 1990s, of the 48 Al Qaeda operatives who were able to come into the United States and establish themselves here, a third became you know, citizens or residents. A third had legal visas. That was really not a failure of immigration policy. I mean, that was a failure of counterterrorism policy, clearly. Those people should never have been allowed in. You know, in the case of Mohammed Atta, he had even overstayed a visa before he was able to get a new one. Again, that man should have been on counterterrorism lists, you know, for a long time. How do we really ensure that nobody who shouldn't get in gets in? Well, you either have a very effective counterterrorism policy, or you simply seal off the borders completely and establish that nobody gets in, which is impossible, which is unrealistic, you know, which would of course hurt the U.S. economy immensely. So I think that it's not fair to place the responsibility or the main responsibility for you know, detecting terrorists trying to come into the country on the shoulders of immigration policy, because if we do that, we will not only hurt the, you know, the legal process of immigration that has so much to offer to the United States, but we will also probably be very ineffective from the point of view of counterterrorism.
Is it your sense that we are wasting the resources we've used in the past few years to beef up border security?
Well, I mean, say in the last 2 or 3 years, about $18 billion has been the overall bill for border security. If you take into account everything, and it's a, you know, a kind of spectrum of measures, and yet you have seen people still coming in, we've seen 21,000 border patrol personnel trying to keep people out, and that hasn't worked very, very effectively. So I just worry that people think that it's simply a question of throwing more money at this and hiring more border patrol personnel. I mean, although some of that is probably inevitable to placate skeptics, it should not be perceived as a panacea for this issue, because it's just not going to work. I think what needs to happen is we need realistic laws, laws that really move reality closer, or the law actually closer to reality, so we don't have this gap. And if supply and demand can match each other, we will see that people will use legal means. I mean, between the 1940s and the 1960s, there was a very interesting period in which a guest worker program called Bracero was able, it was mostly agricultural because that was the type of immigration that was coming in at the time, was able to almost reduce to nothing illegal immigration. They got rid of the program in the 1960s because it became controversial for other reasons. But there have been times in the United States, in U.S. history, and that's a very significant one, in which you saw a very big drop in illegal immigration. And that only happened when the legal obstacles that were not allowing supply and demand to match each other were removed within the framework, of course, of the law.
What does it take for someone who is an upstanding, law-abiding, low-skilled immigrant to come to this country with the proper documentation?
Well, at this point, the problem you have is you have quotas. In other words, beyond a certain number, there's simply no way to come in. Another issue, of course, is that you do have quotas that are very specific to certain industries. So if you're a low-skilled worker who is not up to agricultural work, and that's the only quota that you can really use, then you're probably not going to use it, and you're going to try and come in illegally so you can work in constructions and other industries. So the quotas are really the main problem at this point. The bill that we've been talking about tries to address that to be much more flexible. It not only raises the quotas and the caps, but also tries to be flexible in the sense that if economic conditions dictate, those caps can be raised again. I mean, I'm always skeptical about anticipating the future. I think it's just very hard to know how many workers we will need from, you know, other countries 10 years from now. But the bill does try to address this in a more flexible way than in the past. And that's clearly progress. I mean, that's really the answer to this. We just need more realistic laws.
Do you think there is anything about the current wave of immigration, largely from Latin America, of course not exclusively, that strikes people as more problematic because these individuals are not of European origin?
Yeah, I mean, but it's always been the case. I mean, it was the case with Asian immigration. It was the case with Southern European immigration. It was very interesting because after a period of mostly Western and Northern immigration in the 19th century, the U.S. started to get, after 1980, a very significant number of Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans. And people saw them as people who just didn't fit the kind of immigration profile that was wanted in the country. There was a big backlash. People were, worried that this would mean a degradation almost of U.S. values and U.S. institutions. And today, people look back at that period with nostalgia, and they say, well, we don't want you know, Mexican immigrants. We would like Italian immigrants. But again, Italian immigrants at the time were looked upon as pretty much in the same way that the fiercest critics of Mexican immigration look at Mexicans today. I mean, it's always been the case that people saw the last wave of immigrants as undesirable by comparison to the previous waves of immigrants. I guess it's just human nature.
Are you surprised that this has become such a partisan issue? Because in some ways, I mean, it's not exactly easy to divide this out and put the Democrats on one side and the Republicans on the other.
No, I mean, I think the real battle today is within the Republican Party and the conservative movement at large. I mean, you see some Republicans and conservatives who are very much for immigration, and you see, of course, others who are, you know, dead set against it. So I think that's really the most important debate taking place at this point, because that's really what's going to determine the outcome of any legal effort to change things. Again, if Republicans settle this debate for immigration, then you will see a bill in the House that will be approved in the next few weeks or months. And if they don't win this debate, you will not. If they win this debate, you will see senators and representatives who have been for immigration within the Republican Party probably become viable candidates within the party for the nomination, and vice versa. I mean, it so much depends really on how this debate is settled within the Republican Party, and at this point I'm not really sure who's going to carry the day, because they're really split on this.
We just have about a minute left, but I wonder what lessons you think we can learn from the outcomes that followed the Reagan-era immigration reforms and the elements of that program that worked and the ones that did not.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm going to try to be very, very short. I think the main problem with the 1986 so-called amnesty was that they failed to understand that it's impossible to anticipate the future. What they did is they maintained very strict caps for the future. And of course, those were just completely overwhelmed by reality, so that a few years down the line, we had this new problem with the number of illegal immigrants just mounting, and today they number about 11.5 million. I mean, they did the right thing at the time for those who were in the shadows by bringing them out. They just failed to establish a flexible system for the future. So I think we need to avoid this problem now.
Alvaro Vargas Llosa is Senior Fellow at the Independent Institute and author of the new book, Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Alvaro, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, download the podcast, and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Send those by email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.